Disc 10.
Whether or not the patrol succeeded in capturing prisoners, it would have plenty of support for its retreat back across the river. If either section ran into trouble or got its hands on prisoners, the section leader would blow a whistle to indicate that the withdrawal was underway. That would be the signal for both sections to gather at the boats and for Lieutenant Spears and Sergeant Malarkey to start the covering fire. The covering fire had been worked out down to the smallest details. Every known or anticipated German position was covered by designated rifle fire, machine gun, artillery, and mortar fire. A 57mm anti-tank gun was borrowed from division and emplaced to shoot into the basement of a house that could not be hit by indirect artillery fire. D Company had a 50-caliber machine gun, stolen from the 10th Armored at Bastogne, set up to rake the German positions. The 1st Platoon would have its 30-caliber machine gun set up on the balcony of OP2, ready to spray the German dwelling across the river, if necessary. The crossing would be made right in front of OP2. The night of February 15th was still and dark. The German mortars shot only a couple of flares and one or two 88s. The American artillery was silent, waiting for the whistle. The searchlights were out, as Spears had requested. The Americans shot no flares. There was no small arms firing, there was no moon, there were no stars. The first boat got across successfully. Two others made it. The fourth boat, with McCreary and Cobb in it, capsized. They drifted 100 meters or so downstream, managed to get out, tried again, only to capsize once more. They gave it up as a bad job and returned to OP2. Jones and Mercier gathered the men who had made it over, divided them, and set out on their tasks. With Mercier was a just-arrived replacement from Company F. Without Spears or Winters knowing it, the young officer, gung-ho and eager to prove himself, had attached himself to the patrol. As he followed Mercier up the north bank of the river, he stepped on a shoe mine and was killed. He had been on the front lines barely 24 hours. Mercier continued toward his target, 8 men following him. When he got close enough to the German outpost, he fired a rifle grenade into the cellar window. As it exploded, the men rushed the building and threw hand grenades into the cellar. As those grenades exploded, Mercier led the men into the cellar, so close behind the blast that Private Eugene Jackson, a replacement who had joined up in Holland, was hit in the face and head by fragments of shrapnel. In the cellar, the Americans found the still-living Germans in a state of shock. They grabbed one wounded and 2 uninjured men and dashed back outside. Mercier blew his whistle. The signal unleashed a tremendous barrage. It shook the ground. Heavy artillery from the rear was supplemented by mortars and the anti-tank gun. Webster, watching from the balcony of OP2, described the scene. "We saw a sheet of flame, then a red ball shoot into the basement of a dwelling across the creek. The artillery shells flashed orange on the German roads and strong points. Half a mile away to our direct front, a house started to burn. D Company's 50 caliber opened up behind us in a steady bark. A solid stream of tracers shot up the creek, provoking a duel with a German burp gun, which hosed just as steady a stream of tracers back at D Company from the protection of an undamaged cellar. Mercier and his men dashed back to the boats, where they met Jones in his section. As they started to cross, they decided that the wounded German soldier was too far gone to be of any use, so they abandoned him by the riverbank. One of the replacements, Private Alan Vest, drew a pistol to kill the man, but was told to hold his fire. The wounded German was not going to do them any harm, and there was no point to revealing their position. Some of the men swam, using the boat to pull themselves back across. Others used boats. Once across, the patrol members ran to the cellar at OP2, pushing the 2 prisoners in front of them. As they reached the cellar, the German artillery shell exploded in the backyard, the beginning of a barrage by the Germans all across E Company's line. Down in the cellar, the patrol members crowded around the prisoners. The Americans were excited, many of the men chattering or rather shouting over the tremendous noise, trying to describe individual experiences. Their blood was up. "Let me kill him! Let me kill him!" shouted Vest, rushing toward the prisoners with his pistol drawn. Somebody stopped him. "Get out of here, Vest! They wanted these bastards back at battalion," somebody else yelled. The prisoners, according to Webster, were a pair of very self-possessed noncoms, an Unteroffizier, buck sergeant, and a Feldwebel, or staff sergeant. They stood calm like rocks in a hot, smelly room full of men who wanted to kill them, and they never moved a finger or twisted their expressions. They were the most poised individuals I've ever seen. As the explosions outside increased, Private Jackson, who had been wounded on the patrol, began screaming, "Kill me! Kill me! Somebody kill me! I can't stand it! Christ, I can't stand it! Kill me, for God's sake! Kill me!" His face was covered with blood from a grenade fragment that had pierced his skull and lodged in his brain. Sergeant Martin related, "Of course, no one was going to kill him, because there is always hope. And that goddamn prisoner made me so goddamn mad, I started kicking that goddamn son of a bitch. And I mean, I kicked that bastard every way I could." He concluded lamely, "Emotions were running real high." Someone telephoned for a medic with a stretcher. "Quick." Rose said he would be there in a flash. Jackson continued to call out, "Kill me, kill me. I want Mercier. Where's Mercier?" He was sobbing. Mercier went to him and held his hand. "That's okay, buddy. That's okay. You'll be all right." Someone stuck a morphine syringe in Jackson's arm. He was by then so crazed with pain, he had to be held down on the bunk. Rowe arrived with another medic and a stretcher. As they carried the patient back toward the aid station, Mercier walked beside the stretcher, holding Jackson's hand. Jackson died before reaching the aid station. "He wasn't 20 years old," Webster wrote. "He hadn't begun to live. Shrieking and moaning, he gave up his life on a stretcher." Back in America, the standard of living continued to rise. Back in America, the racetracks were booming, the nightclubs were making their greatest profits in history. Miami Beach was so crowded you couldn't get a room anywhere. Few people seemed to care. Hell, this was a boom. This was prosperity. This was the way to fight a war. We read of black market restaurants, of a manufacturer's plea for gradual reconversion to peacetime goods beginning immediately, and we wondered if the people would ever know what it cost the soldiers in terror, bloodshed, and hideous, agonizing deaths to win the war. During a pause in the German barrage, guards escorted the prisoners back to Captain Winters at Battalion HQ. Mercier was smiling from ear to ear as he handed over the two live prisoners. The buck sergeant talked a lot. The staff sergeant remained silent. The night was no longer peaceful. Both sides fired everything they had. Fires blazed up and down the river. Tracers crisscrossed over the water. Whenever there was a lull, the men at OP2 could hear a wheezing, choking, gurgling sound from across the river. The wounded German soldier, abandoned by the patrol, had been shot in the lungs. Webster and his buddies debated what to do. Kill him and put him out of his misery, or let him die in peace. Webster favored killing him, because if he were left alone, the Germans would send a patrol to fetch him, and he could report on all the activity around OP2. "Then they will shell us even more," Webster predicted. Webster decided to haul himself across the river, using the rope, and knife the man. McCreary vetoed the idea. He said the Germans would use the wounded man as bait for a trap. Webster decided he was right. A hand grenade would be better. Accompanied by Private Bob Marsh, Webster moved cautiously down to the riverbank. He could hear the German gasping and slobbering in ghastly wheezes. "I pitied him," Webster wrote, "dying all alone in a country far from home, dying slowly, without hope or love, on the bank of a dirty little river, helpless." Marsh and Webster pulled the pins on their grenades and threw them beside the German. One exploded, the other was a dud. The wheezing continued. The Americans returned to their outpost, got more grenades, and tried again. The wheezing continued. They gave up. Let him die in his own time. When the shelling finally ceased, just before dawn, the wheezing went on, getting on everyone's nerves. Cobb decided he could take it no more. He grabbed a grenade, went to the riverbank, heaved it over, and finally killed the German. During the night, Sergeant Lipton had been hit by a mortar shell, one fragment on his right cheek close to his ear and the other in the back of his neck. He went to the aid station and got patched up. 34 years later, he had the metal in his neck removed when it started giving him trouble. The following day, February 16th, Winters called Lipton to Battalion HQ to present him with his honorable discharge as an enlisted man, effective February 15th, and a copy of the orders awarding him a battlefield commission as a second lieutenant, effective February 16th. "When I was wounded, I was a civilian," Lipton remarked. "I had already been discharged, and my commission had not yet been effective. I've often wondered how it would have been handled if I had been killed by that mortar shell." He added, "I have always felt that the battlefield commission was the greatest honor that I have ever had." Lieutenant Jones, by all accounts, performed well on his first patrol, meaning apparently he wisely let Mercier make the decisions. Within a week, Jones was gone, having been promoted to first lieutenant. "After one patrol," Lieutenant Foley commented. Jones was a West Pointer, a member of the WPPA, the West Point Protective Association, known by the ring they all wore. It don't mean a thing if you don't have that ring. Jones moved on to a staff job at regiment. Malarkey wrote, "It was rumored that the conclusion of the war was fast approaching and that West Pointers, who would staff the peacetime army, were being protected." Colonel Sink was so delighted with the successful patrol, he ordered another one for the next night. In the meantime, however, it had snowed, then turned colder. The snow was frozen on top, crunchy, noisy. The cold air had cleared out the sky and the moon was shining. Winters thought a patrol under such circumstances was suicidal, so he decided to disobey orders. Sink and a couple of staff officers came to 2nd Battalion CP to observe. They had a bottle of whiskey with them. Winters said he was going down to the riverbank to supervise the patrol. When he got to the outpost, he told the men to just stay still. With the whiskey working on him, Sink would soon be ready for bed. The patrol could report in the morning that it had gotten across the river and into German lines, but had been unable to get a live prisoner. Glenn Gray writes, "To be required to carry out orders in which he does not believe, given by men who are frequently far removed from the realities with which the orders deal, is the familiar lot of the combat soldier. It is a great boon of frontline positions that disobedience is frequently possible, since supervision is not very exact where danger of death is present. Many a conscientious soldier has discovered he could reinterpret military orders in his own spirit before obeying them." Some of the men wanted liquor, too. Cobb and Wiseman went out on a daytime scrounging mission, even though orders were never to show yourself in daylight. They found a cellar filled with schnapps. They grabbed two bottles each and, shot at by German snipers, ran down the street like schoolboys with stolen apples. Wiseman got hit in the knee. He stumbled and fell, breaking his bottles. Cobb saved his. The two men ducked into a cellar and started enjoying the schnapps. "You take a bunch of GIs," Martin pointed out. "There is no such thing as just taking a shot of schnapps. You have to drink the whole goddamn thing before you quit." Wiseman and Cobb drank a bottle each. When they got back to 1st Platoon HQ, roaring drunk, Cobb got into a fight with Marsh. Lieutenant Foley separated the men. He chewed out Cobb for being off limits, disobeying orders, being drunk and disorderly, and so on. Cobb became enraged and began mouthing off. He ignored Foley's direct order to shut up. Instead, he charged Foley. Two men grabbed him and threw him down. Sergeant Martin pulled his .45 pistol. Foley told him to holster his pistol, ordered Cobb arrested, and had him taken back to regiment for lockup. Wiseman, meanwhile, loudly rejected Medic Rowe's order to evacuate. He said he was staying with his friends. Foley got his platoon settled down, then went to regimental HQ to write up court-martial papers for Cobb. It took him several hours. He took the papers to Colonel Sink and told him the details. As Foley was leaving, Sink said to him, "Foley, you could have saved us all a lot of trouble. You should have shot him." Wiseman, still drunk, refused any aid for his wound. He said he would talk to Sergeant Rader, no one else. Rader tried to talk some sense into him without success. He, too, was court-martialed. "This ordeal was another blow to my mind," said Rader, "after Hubler died and Howell was injured at Bastogne." On February 20th, Easy went into reserve as the 3rd Battalion, 506th, took over its position. Within hours of Easy's departure, the Germans scored a direct hit on OP2. Winters got his promotion to major that day. On February 23rd, the 36th Division relieved the 101st. The Airborne Division moved into Saverne in the rear in preparation for a return to Mourmelon. The 101st had seldom been in a rear area. What the men saw there made them wonder how any supplies ever reached the front line. Twice in Hagenau they had received a beer ration of 3 bottles each. The cigarettes they got were Chelsea's or Raleigh's, much despised. No soap, an occasional package of gum, once some toothpaste. Except for C and K rations and ammunition, that was all that reached the front lines. Being near a supply depot in the rear, the men learned why. The port battalions unloading the ships coming from America got their cut. The railroad battalions helped themselves to Milky Way candy bars and cases of Schlitz beer, chalking it up to breakage. The truck drivers took the cartons of Lucky Strikes, by far the favorite brand, and by the time division quartermaster and regimental and battalion S4 skimmed off the best of what was left, the riflemen on the front line were fortunate to get C rations and Raleigh cigarettes. Shifty Powers got a new M1. That was a mixed blessing. He had been using one issued to him in the States. He loved that old rifle. It seemed like I could just point it, and it would hit what I'd pointed at. The best shooting rifle I ever owned. But every time we'd have an inspection, I'd get gigged because it had a pit in it, in the barrel. You can't get those pits out of those barrels, you know. It's pitted in there. He got tired of being gigged, turned it in and got a new M1. And I declare I couldn't hit a barn with that rifle. Awfulest shooting thing there ever was. But at least he wasn't being gigged any longer. Colonel Sink sent down orders to follow a rigorous training schedule while in reserve. Spears thought this an idiotic proposal and made no effort to conceal his sentiments. He told the men of Easy that he believed in training hard and sensibly back in base camp and in taking it easy in a reserve area. Spears could not get the company out of 2 compulsory formations. The first was to hold a drawing for rotation back to the States. 1 man from every company would go home for a 30-day leave. He would be chosen in a company lottery. The winner had to have been in Normandy, Holland, Bastogne, and a total absence of black marks on his service record. No VD, no AWOL, no court-martial. Only 23 men in Easy were eligible. Spears shook up the names in the steel helmet and drew out Forrest Guth's slip. There was a polite cheer. Spears said he hated to lose Guth, but wished him luck. A couple of men shook his hand. The remainder walked sadly away. According to Webster, like men who had glimpsed paradise on their way to hell. The second formation was a battalion review. Spears' philosophy was to avoid the unnecessary, but to do properly and with snap the required. He told the men he wanted them to look sharp. Rifles would be clean, combat suits had to be washed, a huge boiler was set up, the men cooked their clothing with chunks of soap. It took a long time. Private Hudson decided he would skip it. When he showed up for the formation in his filthy combat suit, Spears berated him furiously. Foley, his platoon commander, jumped on him. Sergeant Marsh, his acting squad leader, tried to make him feel the incredible magnitude of his offense. Hudson grinned sheepishly and said, "Gosh, gee whiz, why is everybody picking on me?" General Taylor came for the battalion review, trailed by a division PR photographer. As luck would have it, he stopped before Hudson and talked with him. The photographer took their picture together, got Hudson's name and hometown address, and sent the photo to the local newspaper with a copy to Hudson's parents. Of course, the general looked great talking to a battle-hardened soldier just off the front lines, rather than a bunch of rear-echelon parade ground troopers. So, Webster commented, the only man in E Company with a dirty combat suit was the only man who had his picture taken with the general. We didn't realize it yet, Winters said, but we all started walking with more care, with eyes in the backs of our heads, making sure we didn't get knocked off. After Hagenau, he explained, you suddenly had a gut feeling, by God, I believe I am going to make it. Chapter 15. The Best Feeling in the World. Mourmelon, February 25th through April 2nd, 1945. On February 25th, the men of Easy Company had a unique experience for them, but commonplace for their fathers, riding through France on 40 and 8s, French railway boxcars that held either 40 men or 8 horses. It was the company's first train ride during the war, and it was properly appreciated. The weather was warm and sunny. The 40 and 8s were knee-deep in straw. There was plenty to eat, and no one shot at them. As we jolted through France, Webster wrote, swinging our feet out the door, waving to the farmers, and taking a pull on the schnapps bottle, I thought there was nothing like going away from the front. It was the best feeling in the world. They were returning to Mourmelon, but not to the barracks. This time they were billeted in large green 12-man wall tents, about a mile outside what Webster called the pathetically shabby garrison village of Mourmelon, abused by soldiers since Caesar's day, consisting of 6 bars, 2 whorehouses, and a small Red Cross club. In Webster's scathing judgment, Mourmelon was worse than Fayetteville, North Carolina. The first task was to get clean. There were showers, although the water was lukewarm at best. But for men who had not had a proper shower since leaving Mourmelon 10 weeks ago, the chance to soap and scrub, scrub and soap, lather, rinse and repeat was pure joy. Then they got clean clothes and new Class A uniforms. But when they got to their barracks bags, left behind when the company went to Bastogne, their joy turned to fury. The rear echelon guards had opened the storage area to the 17th Airborne as that division moved into the bulge, and the boys from the 17th had pillaged as if there were no tomorrow. Missing were jumpsuits, shirts, regimental insignia, jump boots, British airborne smocks, panels from Normandy and Holland, parachutes, Lugers, and other priceless souvenirs. The regime imposed by Major Winters added to their discontent. New recruits had come in, and to integrate them into the companies, Winters instituted a rigorous training program. It was like basic all over again, and hated. Webster was so fed up that I sometimes, in forgetful moments, wished to return to the relative freedom of combat. One of the recruits was Private Patrick S. O'Keefe. He had joined the Army when he was 17, gone through jump school, and shipped out from New York on the Queen Elizabeth in late January. I was sound asleep when we passed Ireland, O'Keefe recalled, which disappointed him as both his parents were born in County Kerry, the first landfall for cross-Atlantic traffic. He arrived at Mourmelon shortly after the company returned there. His first impression of the men was that they were all tough, old, and grizzled. I thought, you have bitten off more than you can chew, O'Keefe. He was assigned to 1st Platoon under Lieutenant Foley and Sergeant Christensen. His third night in Mourmelon, O'Keefe went out on a night problem, starting at midnight. Walking in the dark, in single file, he lost sight of the man in front of him and drew a sharp breath. He tensed, looked around. A quiet voice from behind said, "You're okay, son. Just kneel down and look up, and you can catch sight of them against the sky." O'Keefe did, saw them, muttered, "Thanks," and moved on. Later he discovered that the advice had come from Major Winters. So here was Winters, his battalion staff cavorting in Paris, leading an all-night exercise for recruits. O'Keefe took the lead scout position just before dawn. At first light, there was to be a simulated attack against a fixed enemy position on the other side of an open field. O'Keefe got to the last ridge before the target. He signaled with his hand for the battalion to stop. He was nervous at the thought of an 18-year-old kid leading a group of combat-wise veterans. He signaled for the second scout behind him to come forward, with the idea he would ask to trade places. Private Hickman came up with a rush, and before O'Keefe could say a word, blurted out, "Boy, am I glad you're up here. I only joined this outfit 3 weeks ago." Realizing the battalion was full of replacements, restored O'Keefe's gift of gab. "That's okay, kid," he said to Hickman. "I'm going over the ridge to see what's on the other side. You go back and be ready to pass my signal when I give it." In a couple of minutes, O'Keefe was back on the ridgeline, holding his rifle up with both hands as a signal, "Enemy in sight." Foley moved his platoon up to the starting line, shouting, "Lay down a field of fire," and the attack began. After a few minutes of blasting away, Joe Liebgott jumped up, gave an Indian war whoop, rushed toward the objective, and attacked the machine gun pit with his fixed bayonet, ripping open the sandbags, playing the hero. O'Keefe and the other replacements were mightily impressed. On March 8th, Colonel Sink got around to making permanent assignments to officers who had been serving in an active capacity for as long as 2 months. Lieutenant Colonel Strayer became Regimental XO, Major Winters became 2nd Battalion CO. There was some realignment as Major Matheson shifted from Regimental S4 to S3, replacing Captain Nixon, who went from Regimental S3 to S3 for 2nd Battalion. Lieutenant Welsh recovered from his Christmas Eve wound, became 2nd Battalion S2. Captain Sobel replaced Matheson as Regimental S4. Nixon's demotion from regimental to battalion staff came about because of his drinking. Like everyone else who knew him, Sink recognized that Nixon was a genius, in addition to being a brave, common-sense soldier. But Sink, an uninhibited drinker himself, Bourbon Bob was his behind-his-back nickname, could not put up with Nixon's nightly drunks. He asked Winters if Winters could handle Nixon. Winters was sure he could, as they were the closest of friends. Former Easy Company officers were by March occupying key positions in Regiment, S3 and S4, and Battalion. The CO of 1st Battalion was Lieutenant Colonel Hester. Winters was CO of 2nd Battalion, where the S2 and S3 were from Easy. One of their number, Matheson, eventually became a Major General and CO of the 101st Airborne in Vietnam. One is bound to say, one last time, that Captain Sobel must have been doing something right back in the summer of 42 at Tocoa. You could never prove it with Winters, whose feelings for Sobel never softened. Indeed, Sobel's return provided Winters with one of the most satisfactory moments of his life. Walking down the street at Mourmelon, Major Winters saw Captain Sobel coming from the opposite direction. Sobel saw Winters, dropped his head, and walked past without saluting. When he had gone a further step or two, Winters called out, "Captain Sobel, we salute the rank, not the man." "Yes, sir," Sobel answered as he snapped off a salute. Webster and Martin, standing nearby, were delighted. "I like to see officers pull rank on each other," Webster commented, "but not half so much as Winters." Winters had another pleasure at Mourmelon, this one on a daily basis. German POWs were working in the hospital. At dusk each evening, they would march back to their stockade. As they marched, they sang their marching songs. "They sang and marched with pride and vigor," Winters wrote, "and it was beautiful. By God, they were soldiers." The man who had replaced Sobel and Winters as CO of Easy, Captain Spears, continued to impress both officers and enlisted men. "Captain Spears promises to be as good an officer as Winters," Webster thought. He realized that many disagreed with him, men who loathed Spears on the grounds that he had killed one of his own men in Normandy, that he was bullheaded and suspicious, that he believed that there was no such thing as combat exhaustion. But to Webster, he was a brave man in combat. In fact, a wild man who had gotten his Silver Star, Bronze Star, and 3 Purple Hearts legitimately. Spears swears by common sense, combat non-coms, and training with the emphasis on battle rather than the book. I like Spears. There were shake-ups among the non-coms. Sergeant Talbot replaced Lieutenant Lipton as first sergeant. A genial man, Talbot was appreciated by the enlisted men because he ignored red tape and did things by common sense rather than the book. Carson became company clerk, Lutz became a platoon runner, the platoon sergeants, all original Toccoa privates, all wounded at least once, were Charles Grant, second, Amos Taylor, third, and Earl Hale, first. Hale's promotion caused some mumble-mumble in 1st Platoon. The men had nothing against him except that he was an outsider. He had been in Company HQ section as a radio man. The men of the platoon circulated a rumor to the effect that Hale had complained to Winters that his wife was after him to get another stripe, and Winters had given him the platoon as a result. What made the men of the platoon unhappy was the way Johnny Martin got passed over. I guess the officers didn't like his flip attitude, Webster commented. Yet he was the quickest thinker, the best leader among us, and a natural for a platoon sergeant. Martin thought so too. Having survived 3 campaigns without a wound, he decided to let the medics know that he had a trick cartilage in his knee that incapacitated him for combat. He was soon on his way back to the States. The Toccoa men were thinning out like maple leaves in November, Webster wrote. A sense of hopelessness and exasperation filled the old men at Mormolon. Here we were, still hiking over meadow and marsh, still trampling the rutabagas and breaking the fences, still in the field on training exercises. The veterans tried gold bricking to get out of field exercises. They would report on sick call in the morning. Spears would ask the trouble, grunt, and send them to the aid station. There they could get admitted to the hospital for a day of just lying around reading magazines. It was easy to pull. They all did it, but never more than twice. Even Webster preferred pretend war to reading or doing nothing. The Ides of March brought a well-deserved reward to the men of the 101st Airborne. There was a division parade before the most brass the men had ever seen. General Eisenhower was there, along with General Taylor, Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Morgan, Lieutenant General Lewis Brereton, President Roosevelt's Secretary Stephen Early, Major General Matthew Ridgway, and others. In preparation, everybody scrubbed and washed, polished and shined, disassembled, cleaned, and reassembled all weapons, as Lieutenant Foley recalled. Ribbons were dug up and positioned precisely on the blouse. The men painted their helmets, stenciled the insignia of the 506th on the side, and when they were dry, oiled them until they glistened in the sun. There was a practice parade in anticipation. Of course, the officers got the men on the parade ground 3 hours before Ike and his party arrived. Of course, the men cursed the army and its ways. Eisenhower finally arrived. He drove past the whole division, then climbed up on a reviewing stand to give a speech. He announced that the division had received a Presidential Distinguished Unit Citation, the first time in the history of the Army that an entire division had been so cited for its performance at Bastogne. In a short speech, Ike was effusive in his praise. "You were given a marvelous opportunity in Bastogne, and you met every test. I am awfully proud of you." He concluded with a mixture of praise and exhortation. "With this great honor goes also a certain responsibility. Just as you are the beginning of a new tradition, you must realize, each of you, that from now on the spotlight will beat on you with particular brilliance. Whenever you say you are a soldier of the 101st Division, everybody, whether it's on the street, in the city, or in the front line, will expect unusual conduct of you. I know that you will meet every test of the future like you met it at Bastogne." Webster, who was becoming ever more the cynic about the Army, and who was exercising vigorously the soldier's right to grouse, was impressed, in spite of himself. Private O'Keefe commented, "Even the new replacements like myself felt enormous pride in marching in that review." For Lieutenant Foley, there was the surprise to end all surprises. Standing behind General Taylor was his senior aide, none other than Captain Norman Dyke. Sergeant Hale, who had had his throat slashed in the Ardennes, and who had medical permission to go without a tie, had his Bronze Star presented to him by General Eisenhower. Ike wanted to know why he was not wearing a tie. Hale explained. When General Taylor confirmed Hale's story, Ike gave his big laugh and said Hale was the only man in the entire European theater of operations to pull this one off. There were furloughs and leaves to England, the Riviera, Paris, Brussels, and evening passes to Reims. Captain Spears got to go to England, where he had married a British woman who believed her husband had been killed in North Africa. Foley got to Paris, and on return confessed he could not remember a thing. There were some USO shows, with big-name performers, including Marlene Dietrich. Garrison life was soft, but it had its price. To bring discipline and appearance up to a proper rear echelon standard, the Army had to have some method of enforcing rules and regulations. Threatening members of a rifle company that had just come off the line and was about to go back in with a visit to the stockade was less a threat than a promise. Taking hard cash out of the hands of men who were anticipating a pass to Paris, however, caught their attention. A private in the 101st received $50 per month base pay, a $50 bonus for hazardous duty, and an additional $10 for being in the combat zone. General Taylor set up a summary court in Mourmelon, and it began imposing heavy fines for violations. A man found in improper uniform was fined $5. Carrying a Luger in one's pocket cost $25. Speeding in a Jeep or truck cost $20. Disorderly conduct was a $25 offense. Training continued. It progressed through squad and platoon to company and then to battalion level. The division was preparing for a daylight airborne mission, Operation Eclipse, a drop on and around Berlin. No one was going to drop on Berlin until the Allied armies had gotten across the Rhine. For months, the men of Easy had been anticipating a jump on the far side of the river. But when it came, Easy did not participate. Eisenhower decided to give the 17th Airborne a chance at a combat jump and assigned it to Operation Varsity, the largest airborne operation of all time. The 17th plus the British 1st and 6th Airborne Divisions, and to save the 82nd and 101st for Berlin. Non-participation in Operation Varsity was a disappointment to many of the replacements, who had gone through the rigors of jump school, joined the most famous airborne division in the world in Belgium or Germany, and never taken part in a combat jump. At Mourmelon, a unit of Troop Carrier Command made it possible for men who wished to do so to make a few jumps to qualify for their paratrooper bonus, or just for the fun of it. Lieutenant Foley made two, but that wasn't like the real thing. So on March 24th, the members of E Company watched with mixed feelings as one C-47 after another roared down the runway at the nearby airfield, circled, formed up into a V of Vs, nine abreast, and headed northeast. It was a beautiful sight, Foley recalled. It made your heart pump faster, and for a guy like me, having been integrated into a company that had been on two combat jumps, I did feel that I had missed the last opportunity. Some of the old soldiers felt the same way. To his amazement, Webster found himself wishing that he was jumping with the 17th. It would have been fun. Instead, he stood on the ground with his buddies, cheering, giving the V for victory sign, shouting, "Go get 'em, boys! Give 'em hell!" Then, Webster wrote, "I watched them fade in the distance with a dull drone, and I suddenly felt lonely and abandoned, as though I had been left behind." One 506th man who was not left behind was Captain Nixon. General Taylor selected him to jump with the 17th as an observer for the 101st. Fortunately for Nixon, he was assigned to be jump master of his plane. The plane was hit. Only Nixon and three others made it out before it crashed. Nixon was attached to the 17th for only one night. On March 25th, he was sent back over the Rhine and flown by a special small plane to the 2nd Battalion in Mourmelon. The jump qualified Nixon to be one of two men in the 506th eligible to wear three stars on his jump wings, Normandy, Holland, and Operation Varsity. The other was Sergeant Wright of the Pathfinders, who had been in Easy Company back at Tekoa. German resistance to Operation Varsity was fierce. Meanwhile, infantry and armored divisions of the U.S. First Army were pouring across the Rhine via the recently captured Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, then swinging north to encircle the German army defending Germany's industrial heartland in the Ruhr. Eisenhower needed to bolster the ring around the Ruhr. The 82nd and 101st were available. The orders came at the end of March. The company was moving out, back to the front, this time on the Rhine River. The veterans resolved not to take any chances. The end of the war was in sight, and they now believed what they could not believe at Bastogne, that they were going to make it, safe, more or less intact. They wanted to escape the boredom of garrison. They knew how to take care of themselves. They were ready to do their job, but not to be heroes. In contrast to the veterans, the replacements thought Mourmelon was a super place. They trained with veterans day and night in realistic problems, all under the watchful eye of a man who was a legend in E Company, Major Winters. They had learned life-saving lessons. They had gotten to know and be accepted by the veterans. They were proud to be in the company, the regiment, the division, and were eager to show that they were qualified to be there. So Easy was ready at the end of March, when orders came to prepare to move out. It would be by truck to the Rhine. Webster was delighted to be getting out of Mourmelon, apprehensive and excited about going back into combat, and disappointed that he was not jumping into battle. "I had hoped to make another jump," he wrote, "rather than ride to the front in trucks, for there is an element of chance in an airborne mission. It may be rough, it may be easy. Perhaps there will be no enemy at all, which appeals to me more than the prosaic infantry attack against an enemy who knows where you are and when you're coming." Private O'Keefe was about to enter combat for the first time. He has a vivid memory of the occasion. "We wore light sweaters under field jackets, trousers bloused over combat boots, trench knife strapped on right leg, pistol belts with attached musette bags, one phosphorus grenade and one regular hand grenade taped onto our chest harness, canteens, first aid kit, K-rations stuffed into our pockets, steel helmet and rifle. We carried cloth bandoliers for our rifle clips in place of the old-fashioned cartridge belts. Our musette bags carried a minimum of shorts, socks, shaving gear, sewing kit, cigarettes, etc. After hearing Mass celebrated by Father John Maloney and receiving a general absolution, O'Keefe pulled himself into a truck and was off for Germany. Easy Company was about to enter its fifth country. The men had liked Britain and the English people enormously. They did not like the French, who seemed to them ungrateful, sullen, lazy, and dirty. They had a special relationship with the Belgians because of their intimate association with the civilians of Bastogne, who had done whatever they could to support the Americans. They loved the Dutch, brave, resourceful, overwhelmingly grateful, the best organized underground in Europe, cellars full of food hidden from the Germans but given to the Americans, clean, hard-working, honest, were only some of the compliments the men showered on the Dutch. Now they were going to meet the Germans. For the first time, they would be on front lines inside enemy territory, living with enemy civilians. And if the rumor proved true, the one that said instead of living in foxholes, they were going to be billeted in German houses, they would be getting to know the Germans in an intimate fashion. This would be especially true once the Ruhr pocket was eliminated and the advance across central Germany began. Then they would be staying in a different house every night under conditions in which the occupants would have only a few minutes' notice of their arrival. They would be coming as conquerors who had been told to distrust all Germans and who had been forbidden by the non-fraternization policy to have any contact with German civilians. But except for Liebgott and a few others, they had no undying hatred of the Germans. Many of them admired the German soldiers they had fought, Webster was not alone in feeling that most of the atrocities they had heard about were propaganda. Anyway, they would soon see for themselves whether all the Germans were Nazis, and if the Nazis were as bad as the Allied press and radio said they were. Chapter 16. Getting to Know the Enemy. Germany, April 2nd through 30th, 1945. The reactions of the men of Easy to the German people depended on their different preconceptions and experiences. Some found reasons to reinforce their hatred. Others loved the country and the people. Nearly everyone ended up changing his mind. All of them were fascinated. The standard story of how the American GI reacted to the foreign people he met during the course of World War II runs like this. He felt the Arabs were despicable, liars, thieves, dirty, awful, without a redeeming feature. The Italians were liars, thieves, dirty, wonderful, with many redeeming features, but never to be trusted. The rural French were sullen, slow, and ungrateful, while the Parisians were rapacious, cunning, indifferent to whether they were cheating Germans or Americans. The British people were brave, resourceful, quaint, reserved, dull. The Dutch were, as noted, regarded as simply wonderful in every way. But the average GI never was in Holland, only the airborne. The story ends up thus. Wonder of wonders, the average GI found that the people he liked best, identified most closely with, enjoyed being with, were the Germans. Clean, hardworking, disciplined, educated, middle class in their tastes and lifestyles. Many GIs noted that, so far as they could tell, the only people in the world who regarded a flush toilet and soft white toilet paper as a necessity were the Germans and the Americans. The Germans seemed to many American soldiers as just like us. GIs noted with approval that the Germans began picking up the rubble the morning after the battle had passed by, and contrasted that with the French, where no one yet had bothered to clean up the mess. Obviously, they noted with high approval all those young German girls and the absence of competition from young German boys. They loved the German food and beer, but most of all, they loved the German homes. They stayed in many homes, from the Rhine through Bavaria to Austria, sometimes a different one each night. Invariably, they found running hot and cold water, electric lights, a proper toilet and paper, coal for the stove. Webster wrote of this period, "Coming off guard into your own home was a sensation unequaled in the army. We left the hostile blackness behind when we opened the outside door. Beyond the blackout curtains, a light glowed, and as we hung our rifles on the hat rack and shed our raincoats, idle chatter drifted from the kitchen and gave us a warm, settled feeling. A pot of coffee would be simmering on the stove. Help yourself. Reese would be telling about a shack job he had in London, while Janovich, Hickman, Colette, and Schulte played blackjack. Wash your hands at the sink. This was home. This was where we belonged. A small, sociable group, a clean, well-lighted house, a cup of coffee. Paradise. Even better, the men were not getting shot at or shooting. No wonder so many of them liked Germany so much. But as Webster commented, in explaining the superficial fondness of the GI for the Germans, it might be well to remember the physical comforts which he enjoyed nowhere else in the army but in the land of his enemies. The experiences of the men of E Company in Germany illustrates how much better off during the war the German people were than the people of Britain, France, Belgium, and Holland. Of course, in the big cities in Germany, it was, by mid-April of 1945, Gute Dammerung. But in the countryside and small villages, where, although there was usually some destruction at the main crossroads, the houses generally were intact, complete with creature comforts such as most people thought existed in 1945 only in America. By no means was every GI seduced by the Germans. Webster went into Germany with a complex attitude. He didn't like Germans. He thought all Germans were Nazis. But he discounted as propaganda the stories about concentration camps and other atrocities. He found the German people too hard-faced. He thought the French were dead and rotting. But Germany was only a crippled tiger licking its wounds, resting with a burning hatred in its breast, ready to try again. And it will. Despite himself, Webster was drawn to the people. The Germans I have seen so far have impressed me as clean, efficient, law-abiding people, he wrote his parents on April 14th. They were churchgoers. In Germany, everybody goes out and works, and unlike the French, who do not seem inclined to lift a finger to help themselves, the Germans fill up the trenches soldiers have dug in their fields. They are cleaner, more progressive, and more ambitious than either the English or the French. Writing of the GI's experience with the German people, and of the effect of feeling that they were just like us, Glenn Gray points out, "The enemy could not have changed so quickly from a beast to a likable human being. Thus, the conclusion is nearly forced upon the GIs that they have been previously blinded by fear and hatred and the propaganda of their own government." Orders from on high were non-fraternization. GIs were not supposed to talk to any Germans, even small children, except on official business. This absurd order, which flew in the face of human nature in so obvious a way, was impossible to enforce. Officers, especially those who hated the Germans, tried anyway. Webster was amused by the intensity of Lieutenant Foley's feelings. He wrote that Foley had become such a fiend on the non-fraternization policy that he ordered all butts field-stripped, that is, torn apart and scattered, so that the Germans might derive no pleasure from American tobacco. Webster also recalled the time that he and Foley were picking out houses for the night. "As we walked around to the backyard for a closer inspection, we were greeted with a horrifying spectacle that aroused all the non-fraternization fervor in Foley. Two infantrymen sociably chatting with a couple of Fräulein. Unspeakable, outrageous, unmilitary, forbidden. Lieutenant Foley gave them hell and bade them be on their way." With the resigned air of men who knew the barren futility of the non-fraternization policy, the gallants sulkily departed. It is worth pausing here to see the Americans as conquerors through the microcosm of E Company. They took what they wanted, but by no means did they rape, loot, pillage, and burn their way through Germany. If they did not respect property rights, in the sense that they commandeered their nightly billets without compensation, at least when the Germans moved back in after they left, the place was more or less intact. Of course, there were some rapes, some mistreatment of individual Germans, and some looting. But it is simple fact to state that other conquering armies in World War II, perhaps most of all the Russian, but including the Japanese and German, acted differently. Webster told a story that speaks to the point. Rees, who was more intent on finding women than in trading for eggs, and I, made another expedition, a mile west to a larger village where there were no GIs. Like McCreary, Rees tended to show an impatience with hens and a strong interest in skirts. Regardless of age or appearance, he'd tell me, "There's a nice one. Boy, that's a honey. Speak to her, Webb, goddamn." Since I was shy, however, and those females invariably looked about as sociable as a fresh iceberg, I ignored his panting plaints. Besides, the Fraus weren't apt to be friendly in public, where the neighbors could see them. Maybe indoors or at night. Finally, we came to a farm where a buxom peasant lass greeted us. Rees smiled. After I had gotten some eggs, Rees, who kept winking at her, gave her a cigarette and a chocolate bar, and as love bloomed in the garden of D-Ration, a newly issued food package, and Chelsea's, I backed out of the door and waited in the sun. "No dice," Rees later reported. I returned home with a helmet full of eggs, Rees with a broken heart. But it was, as he said, good fraternizing territory. He tried again that night before 6 o'clock curfew went into effect. No luck. Had Rees been a Soviet, German, or Japanese soldier, this little non-incident probably would have turned out differently.
The company moved by truck from Mourmelon to the Ruhr pocket. The 101st took up positions on the west bank of the Rhine facing Düsseldorf.
The 2nd Battalion sector was from Stutzelberg on the north to Vorringham on the south, with the 82nd Airborne on the battalion's right flank. The 82nd faced Cologne. It was more an occupation position than front line. The platoons kept outposts down on the riverbank, while the men stayed in homes in various small villages. There was some artillery shelling back and forth, but not much. There was no small arms fire. The men were on outpost each night. Here, Private O'Keefe got his initiation. One night, he was on outpost with Private Harry Lager, who had also just joined the company at Mourmelon in a ready-made foxhole beside the dike. They heard a thump, thump, thump. O'Keefe whispered to Lager, "Stay in the hole, but make room for me to drop in a hurry. I'm going up on that dike to see if I can make out what that is approaching." "Up on the dike," O'Keefe recalled. "I couldn't see a damn thing, but the noise was almost on top of me. Suddenly the nose of a small tank stuck out through the fog. I yelled, 'Halt, who goes there?' and ready to dive off that dike into the hole with Lager. A voice came out of the tank, 'It's just a couple of limeys and we're lost.' O'Keefe ordered the men to come down to be inspected. A British sergeant did so, saying, 'By God, Yank, are we glad to see you. We started out on that bloody dike at midnight and we can't find our way off.' 'What's making that noise?' O'Keefe asked. 'Oh, that,' the Brit replied. 'It's one of our treads. It's broke. We can only travel about 2 miles an hour. The tread goes around but hits the ground on each rotation.' O'Keefe suggested that the sergeant put his crewmate out in front, walking ahead, else they might get plastered at the next checkpoint. The sergeant said he would. O'Keefe rejoined Lager, glad to note that Lager had them covered with his M1 the whole time. The little incident gave Lager and O'Keefe confidence in themselves and one another. They decided they had the hang of it. Another night, at another place along the river, O'Keefe was on outpost with a recent recruit, Private James Welling. From West Virginia, Welling was 30 years old, making him just about the oldest man in the company. O'Keefe was the youngest. Although Welling had just joined the company, he was a combat veteran who had been wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, volunteered for paratroopers after discharge from hospital in England, made all 5 qualifying jumps in one day, and was now a member of the 101st. On the outpost, they were standing in a waist-deep foxhole when a 10-ton truck came barreling along the road. "Halt!" O'Keefe yelled, 3 times. No one heard him. A convoy of 9 trucks, bumper to bumper, passed him by, engines roaring. "What do you do when you yell halt and you realize they'll never hear you?" O'Keefe asked Welling. "Not much you can do," he replied. 1/2 hour later, the trucks came back, full speed, except now there were only 8 trucks. "Jim, what's down that road?" O'Keefe asked.
"I don't know. Nobody said."
1/4 hour later, Captain Spears showed up, madder than hell. He shouted at Welling, "Why didn't you stop those trucks? The bridge is out down there, and one of those trucks is now hanging over the edge." Having heard various stories about Spears' temper, O'Keefe expected the worst. But Welling shouted right back, "How the hell were we going to stop 9 trucks going full bore? And why didn't someone tell us the bridge was out? Hell, we didn't even know there was a bridge there." "Where's the other guard?" Spears demanded. O'Keefe stepped out of a shadow with his M1 pointed about waist high and said as menacingly as he could, "Right here, sir." Spears grunted and left. A night or so later, a jeep came along, no lights. Welling called out, "Halt!" The jeep contained Captain Spears, another captain, and a major in the back seat. Welling said the password. Spears gave the countersign in a normal conversational tone. Welling couldn't make out what he had said and repeated the challenge. Spears answered in the same tone. Welling still didn't hear him. Tense and a bit confused, O'Keefe lined up his M1 on the major in the back. He looked closely and realized it was Winters. Welling gave the password for the 3rd time. The captain, who was driving, finally realized Welling had not heard and yelled out the countersign. Spears jumped out of the jeep and started to curse out Welling. Welling cut him off. "When I say halt, I mean halt. When I give the password, I expect to hear the countersign." Spears started sputtering about what he was going to do to Welling when Winters interrupted. "Let's go, Captain," he said in a low voice.
As they drove off, Winters called out to Welling, "Good job."
There were patrols across the Rhine, seldom dangerous except for the strong current in the flooded river nearly 350 meters wide. When Winters got orders on April 8th to send a patrol to the other side, he decided to control the patrol from an observation post to make certain no one got hurt. Winters set the objectives and controlled the covering artillery concentration, then monitored the patrol step by step up the east bank of the river. Lieutenant Welsh, Battalion S2, accompanied him and was disgusted with the safety limits Winters insisted on. "We went through the motions of a combat patrol," Winters remembered, "and found nothing. Everyone returned safely." Most patrols were similarly unsuccessful. Malarkey reported that a replacement officer took out a patrol, got across the river, advanced several hundred yards inland, drew fire from a single rifleman, reported over the radio that he had met stiff resistance and withdrew to friendly territory, to the mingled relief and disgust of his men. A couple of days later, things didn't work out so well. The patrol leader was Major William Leach, recently promoted and made Regimental S2 by Sink. He had been ribbed unmercifully back at Mourmelon when his gold leaves came through. "When are you going to take out a patrol, Leach?" his fellow officers asked. He had never been in combat and consequently had no decorations. Characterized by Winters as a good staff officer who made his way up the ladder on personality and social expertise, Leach wanted to make a career out of the Army. For that, he felt he needed a decoration. On the night of April 12th, Leach set out at the head of a four-man patrol from the S2 section at Regimental HQ, but he made one fatal mistake. He failed to tell anyone he was going. Easy Company men on outpost duty heard the splashing of a boat the patrol was using as it crossed the river. As far as they were concerned, unless they had been told of an American patrol at such and such a time, any boat in the river contained enemy troops. They opened up on it. Quickly, the machine guns joined in. The fire ripped the boat apart and hit all the men in it, including Leach. Ignoring the pitiful cries of the wounded drowning in the river, the machine gunners kept firing bursts at them until their bodies drifted away. They were recovered some days later downstream. In the judgment of the company, Leach and four men had perished in a most unnecessary, inexcusable fashion because he had made an obvious and unpardonable mistake.
This is the end of Disc 10.